The story is not meant to illustrate how one may beat the odds. Rather, it shows that conventional power, that is, military power, is not the only power there is. That is why David goaded Goliath by noting that the Philistine was coming at him with sword, spear, and javelin. But he brought into battle something else. The Bible is full of stories that we all know and love. But how well do we know them? The answer might surprise you. The Bible you thought you knew is going to dive deep into the exquisite details of the biblical stories that make them fascinating and transforming. Arguably, few biblical stories are as famous as David and Goliath. Even if you do not know the story well, you have a decent grasp of the outline. Goliath was a Philistine warrior, a grizzled military veteran who happened to be huge. Indeed, he was said to be a giant. David, on the other hand, was a shepherd boy of ordinary size. When a trained soldier goes up against a kid armed only with a shepherd's slingshot, and that soldier would dwarf an NFL offensive lineman, the outcome is all but inevitable. No one in Las Vegas would take bets on David. In fact, the bookies would hate a contest like this. This is because no one in their right mind would lay odds on David's having even a remote chance of coming out on top. For this very reason, David versus Goliath is often alluded to in sports. This story is always invoked when a highly unlikely upset occurs. No one talks about David and Goliath in the NCAA football championship because typically the two teams who have made it that far are evenly matched. One team might be favored over another, but only slightly. That circumstance makes bookies salivate. Betting money will come in truckloads when the results of the game are basically anybody's guess. Once in a while, of course, teams that, quote-unquote, on paper, have no hopes of winning, do in fact win. That is when it is proclaimed that David defeated Goliath. When the 1980 United States Olympic hockey team was victorious over the heavily favored Soviet Union team, which was basically a professional team going against rank amateurs, it was called a miracle on ice. No one foresaw a USA David beating a USSR Goliath on that day. So, the David and Goliath story has become one of the most used metaphors in the sports world to describe a contest which defies the odds. Indeed, it has become a cliché. The metaphor is sometimes used in the non-sports world as well. In 2016, no political pundit, virtually no polls, and no expert analyst of the American political scene thought that Donald Trump had even an outside chance of winning the presidential election over Hillary Clinton. In fact, those in the know scoffed at the idea that Trump had any shot whatsoever of getting the Republican nomination. Once again, in 2016, there was a David and Goliath scenario. Now, notwithstanding this popular application of this well-known story, I want to ask this question. Is the David and Goliath story, as a matter of fact, a David and Goliath story? That is the point of the story to demonstrate that from time to time it is possible to beat the odds? Is the story meant to encourage someone to throw caution to the wind and be fearless when one is confronted with a formidable and presumably unbeatable opponent? Is this a biblical version of positive thinking? Should this story provide material for motivational speakers? Granted, as we mentioned, There is no debate that this is how the story has been appropriated. But the question remains, is that a legitimate take on this famous episode? I hope you will forgive me for saying that I do not think so. Of course, the burden of proof is on me, since beating the odds is exactly the way this story has been conventionally interpreted. Once again, though, I argue that the textual details in the story point us in another direction. Let us see whether I can make my case. If you want to check out the biblical passage in which the story appears, read chapters 16 and 17 of 1 Samuel. Beginning with David, we can start by establishing that he was a shepherd. In fact, his involvement in that occupation made his father hesitant to present him as a candidate for king. David's father, Jesse, had noted that David was his youngest son and was with the sheep when Samuel the prophet had asked Jesse whether he had any other sons. Remember that Samuel had already considered anointing 7 of David's siblings to be king. It is not clear why Jesse thought that David's youth or being a shepherd should disqualify him. David's connection with sheep is also emphasized when Jesse sends him to check on his 3 brothers who were serving in the army of Saul, Israel's current king. We are told that at that time, David went back and forth from Saul to tend his sheep. That's in 1 Samuel 17, verse 15. David's going back and forth between his sheep and Saul makes sense, since David had already had a relationship to King Saul. When Samuel anointed David to be the next king, God's Spirit came upon him while leaving Saul at the same time. Even worse for Saul, an evil spirit from God began to afflict the current king. Keep in mind that both God and Samuel had denounced Saul for previous disobedience. That was when David came into the picture. Saul's closest aides saw that he suffered greatly when the evil spirit attacked the king. To deal with that, they suggested that soothing music might alleviate the problem. At that point, one of Saul's advisors brings up David, though he does not mention his name or his being a shepherd. What he does say about him, however, is astounding. Compared to how Jesse evaluated his son, he is the youngest and he is with the sheep, Saul's advisor over-nominates David with lavish praise. He notes that David, at this point simply referred to as a son of Jesse, is a skilled musician, a man of valor, an experienced military man, a superb orator, someone who presented himself well, and just in case there was any doubt of his qualifications at all, the Lord was with him. How did David get such a resume? Had David's reputation along those lines been widely known, why would his father have been so reluctant to have Samuel anoint him? Plus, how did Saul's aide know this, when there is not a stitch of this anywhere in the previous narrative? It is impossible to answer those questions. In any case, Saul was impressed and sent messengers to Jesse so that they could bring David into his inner circle. Even then, David's connections with sheep is accented. Indeed, the 2 things Saul was not told about David was his name or his occupation. Nevertheless, when Saul sends for David, he asks for David by name and even mentions his being with the sheep. When David joins Saul, he not only strums the lyre when the king is being bothered by the evil spirit from God, but he is also designated Saul's armor bearer. Curiously, though, when the Goliath incident develops, David is home with Jesse, his dad, and with the sheep. That takes care of David, at least for now. What about Goliath? this is where the story gets even more intriguing. As the episode gets underway, we discover that the only reason we know Goliath's name is because the narrator tells us twice, in verse 4 and verse 23 of chapter 17. But no character in the story calls Goliath by name. Nor does Goliath call himself by that name. 21 times in the story, the narrator, or Saul, or David, refers to Goliath as the Philistine. Twice, David adds uncircumcised to this moniker in order to insult this menace to the Israelite army. Indeed, one time Goliath uses the term the Philistine in a self-reference, something that most English translations get wrong when they render the Hebrew statement as, "Am I not a Philistine?" That's in verse 8 of chapter 17. But the presence of the definite article "the" is unmistakable in the text. What is the significance of this way of referring to this threatening soldier? It makes little sense to take it as simply an ethnic description. The man is part of the Philistine army. Would it not be absurdly redundant to add that he happened to be a Philistine himself? The reason this phrase is used to describe Goliath becomes clear when we pay attention to how he is introduced in the story. When Goliath first appears, he is called, strangely, a man of the betweens. That phrase is unique in this story, occurring in verses 4 and 23 of chapter 17. Typically, the phrase is translated as champion, but that is a guess. It may merely mean infantryman, but given its uniqueness, all we can do is guess. Either it is an idiom, the nuance of which is now lost on us, or it is a technical military term whose true meaning is not known. In any case, as more details are supplied to introduce the Philistine soldier, the Hebrew text is not in the least ambiguous. As we might guess from what we have always thought about this character in the story, he was a large man. Specifically, he was 6 cubits and a span tall. The Greek version reduces his height by 2 cubits. Assuming we know what the Hebrew measurements signify, we can safely say that this soldier was uncommonly tall. Was he taller than any Israelite soldier? Probably. But keep in mind that we were told when Samuel introduced Saul to the Israelite community after he had been anointed king that he was, quote, taller than any of the people. That's in 1 Samuel 10, verse 23. So Israel's army boasted a tall soldier as well. In fact, it was King Saul, the commander-in-chief. Still, the question remains, was size Goliath's chief asset? It seems not. Why do I say this? Well, when the narrator informs us of the Philistine size, he employs only 3 Hebrew words. Conversely, when the narrator describes Goliath's armor, he uses 3 full verses. If the man's size were the decisive issue, why spend all that time telling the reader about his military garb? No detail is spared. We learn that he wore a helmet which was made of bronze. He was also outfitted with a coat of mail which weighed 5,000 bronze shekels. Why do we need to know what it weighed? Then we discover that his legs were covered with bronze greaves. The man is all but invulnerable. Those items, of course, are defensive in nature. But the narrator goes on to list offensive weapons. Goliath sported a bronze javelin. If telling us that is not sufficiently impressive, we learn as well that the spear's shaft was as thick as a weaver's loom. The icing on the cake comes when we realize that the spearhead, the part that would penetrate the flesh of a rival soldier, weighed 600 shekels of iron. Then, for good measure, the narrator lets us know that the Philistine went into battle behind his own personal shield bearer. In Sunday school, we obsessed about Goliath's size. The biblical text, on the other hand, underscores boldly his defensive armor and his offensive capability. Later in the story, we discover that he wielded a sword, too. Why do I make so much of this? I do so because this explains why he is referred to so often by the narrator, Saul, David, and even Goliath himself as the Philistine. In this story, he is being presented as the epitome of conventional military power. Let me encourage you to think of the matter in the following terms. In an athletic context, a person's size, speed, agility, power, balance, stamina, and the like make all the difference between winning or losing. When your favorite football or baseball team loses a Super Bowl or World Series, you would never blame that terrible outcome on equipment. Does anyone think that when the Seattle Seahawks won the Super Bowl, it was because they had better shoulder pads or helmets than their opponents? The Seattle Mariners have never been to a World Series. There are many reasons to explain this, but no one would ever suggest that the problem is that they need to buy better gloves, wear superior cleats, or use different wood for their bats. In athletic endeavors, the athletes make the difference. In a military context, equipment makes the difference. In fact, it is the decisive factor. For example, a 116-pound woman who has been trained to fly an F-16 fighter will be as formidable as a 6'4", 225-pound male pilot who happens to be a bodybuilder. The lethality in this example is the F-16's capabilities, not the athletic prowess of its pilot. In any assessment of a nation's military power, one takes into account the number and sophistication of ships, planes, tanks, artillery, and the like, not how athletically inclined the soldiers are. Granted, a degree of physical ability is necessary for any good army, but the armaments themselves are determinative. 1,000 soldiers, armed with Revolutionary War muskets, would have no chance against 100 soldiers armed with modern, up-to-date M16s. For this reason, the narrator of the David and Goliath story took such pains to describe the Philistines' armor to the nth degree. No one in the Israelite army answered the Philistines' challenge, not even the extremely tall King Saul. When one is outmatched in terms of a military arsenal, attack would have been the same as suicide. This is illustrated when David offers to take on Goliath and is consequently brought to Saul. First, Saul tries to talk David out of this foolishness. The king points out that David is merely a kid, whereas the Philistine has been a trained warrior since he was a king. By the way, Saul mentions only Goliath's ability as a soldier. He utters not a word about the man's size. Second, Saul says that if David persists in this folly, he should at least don armor. David tries to comply, but finds the armor cumbersome, more a liability than an asset. This is the narrator's way of explaining that David is going to use another kind of power versus Goliath's conventional military power. David says as much when he brags to Saul about his ability to protect his sheep from animal predators. Famously, when David confronted the Philistine, he had no sword in his hand, even though his opponent was armed with a sword, a spear, and a javelin. In a doubly ironic manner, David felled the Philistine with a slingshot and then decapitated him with his own sword. The story is not meant to illustrate how one may beat the odds. Rather, it shows that conventional power, that is, military power, is not the only power there is. That is why David goaded Goliath by noting that the Philistine was coming at him with sword, spear, and javelin. But he brought into battle something else. David goes on to say that God's power consists in something besides sword and spear. David used this unconventional power to defeat the Philistine, who epitomized conventional military power. Goliath was the quintessential Philistine, which exuded ultimate military power. But he was soundly beaten by David, who at this point represented the quintessential Israelite, who possessed another sort of power entirely. David said as much when he said that he came in the name of his God, and coming in the name of that God meant that there are other forms of power. There is the power of sacrificial love. There is the power of prophetic justice. There is the power of ethics. There are other forms of power other than politics, other than the military, and that is what is illustrated by David's defeating the Philistine. I want to thank you so very much for listening to The Bible You Thought You Knew. I have a question for you. Do you have a question or topic that you'd like me to cover on the podcast? If so, all you need to do is head over to Apple Podcasts and do two simple things. One, leave a rating and review telling me what you think of the podcast. Two, in that review, ask anything you want related to the Bible. That's all you have to do. Then, listen in to hear your question answered on a future episode. Join us next time on The Bible You Thought You Knew when we discuss Jesus' personal Bible. God bless.